This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Ian Davis is with me today once again, I am very happy to say. Ian is an independent journalist, researcher, author, and blogger who is based in the UK. He publishes frequently at his website, iandavis.com, as well as offguardian.org, unlimitedhangout.com, and ukcolumn.org. Ian, how goes it, my friend?
Oh, I'm very well, Jesse. How are you?
I am okay. I just learned that I've been blocked on Twitter or from accessing my Twitter account for posting so-called medical misinformation in the form of calling out Russia for still pushing toxic injections on its population. So there's that. And I resolved a long time ago that if and when this day came, I would not delete the allegedly offensive tweet just to regain access. I would not censor myself. So my Twitter days are over.
Well, fair play, mate. I appreciate that. That's good of you. I must admit, I've been suspended and I've deleted the tweets. But I think it's a difficult judgment call to make, isn't it? I mean, I think it all depends on how much we are able to interact with other people that may not be aware of some of the things that we discuss. But I mean, increasingly on Twitter, it seems pretty evident to me that we're just moving around in silos, really. I don't think I've even, you know, unless you actively comment on someone's post who's expressing a different opinion. And even then, I don't think, you know, because I've been shadow banned a few times as well. And I don't know whether I currently am, but I think I probably am. So even then, if you comment on, you know, you try to offer a different opinion to try and engage people in debate who have got a different view to you, it's a fairly useless platform for that as well. So I think the next time it happens to me, I will follow your example, mate.
Yes, I agree. It is a judgment call. But for me, I don't want to play their game. This happened to me once before last year, and I deleted the tweet. But as I said, after that, I resolved to not play their game again. So that's all. It's not the worst thing in the world. It's not even a bad thing. I still have my Telegram channel, and I find that much more useful than Twitter. And I agree, we are very much moving around in silos on there. I can tell I've been shadow banned for quite some time. And more than anything else, it's become a source of aggravation and frustration. So good riddance. So
yeah, no, I agree. I mean,
go ahead.
Sorry, mate. No, I'm just saying, I mean, social media is a time vacuum, isn't it? I mean, we just end up basically just wasting quite a lot of time on there. You know, and although, I mean, I have to say that, you know, often, you know, communicating with different people, you learn a lot of new stuff. You know, I mean, there's certainly quite a lot of links that I've been sent and so forth that I found very interesting. So there's that aspect to it. So it swings and roundabouts, I guess. But I mean, I think increasingly one of the things that I've discussed at length and one of the things that the UK column as well and have discussed is, you know, in the UK, we've got the proposed online safety act coming. And that is going to make a massive difference to free speech online in the UK. And it's the similar across the world. We see the same kind of legislation happening in places like, you know, Russia and and in the US. They have not gone down the legislative route. They've gone more down the, you know, the kind of uh, the regulatory overlord ombudsman route. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's the same oppressive, I would say, anti-democratic kind of restrictions on increasing in, and this is, you know, it's the slowly but surely, you know, they're increasing the level of censorship and oppression. I mean, I think if mm-hmm. they did these things all in the space of a month, you know, people probably would react to it. But if they just gradually remove a little bit more freedom here and a little bit more, you know, some more of your rights here and a few rights there, people gradually acclimatize to it. And, you know, it's almost like they don't notice what they've lost until it's gone. But unfortunately, I think very soon, you know, far more people are going to start to realize what is being taken away from them.
Right. And I see, not to get stuck on this Twitter point, because I do want to talk about something else that's much more important. But the last thing I'll say is that it seems this dangling out of a carrot in the form of delete this tweet and we'll give you access back is a way to measure and mine people's compliance, what they're willing to do to get access back to certain things, right? So I don't want to play into that either. Whether or not they're measuring and tracking that, I don't know. But in this day and age, I wouldn't put it past them. But just...
Well, they're measuring and tracking everything. You know, right. not just on social media. I mean, if you make a complaint to your local energy company, they're measuring and tracking that. You know, I mean, it's everything. So I think the idea, you know, people that have talked about, you know, the idea of a free internet free of surveillance. You know, I mean, I think that's quite a silly proposition, really, because it's always been. I mean, we can look at programs like the Prison Program, and we can look at things like GCHQ were in the UK have been, you know, tapping the fiber optic cables directly. You know, I mean, it's pretty basic stuff, but they've been doing that for years. So I mean,
right?
You know, it's the idea that we're not surveilled is a moribund point, really. But I think I agree with something that Mike from UK Column once said to me. You know, if I ever said something that I thought was harmful to somebody else, or, you know, something that I felt morally uncomfortable about saying, or something that I, you know, then why, you know, I would never say anything like that. It's not like I, you know, I'm like yourself, Jesse. I mean, I'm not going to advocate a crime, that someone commits a crime or anything like that,
right,
or that somebody harms someone else. So if I'm going to be surveilled and my freedom of speech curtailed for expressing perfectly legitimate views, then so be it. But I'm certainly not going to stop expressing those legitimate views just because I'm worried about what someone might think about them. But I mean, I think the problem is, and this is where it does become more difficult. What if, you know, your job perhaps is placed in jeopardy? I mean, we've just seen recently, I think an actor, can't remember which one it was now, but he made some comment online, and that's you know, the actors union and stuff are upset about what he said. So will that jeopardise him getting future work? It may well do. And I think that's where it becomes a bit of a grey area, and where people understandably do, it's a form of self-censorship, isn't it? People are worried about what other people might think, especially if it affects their livelihoods.
Right. It's a trap in the end, all of these platforms, no matter which one we're talking about. And it's ironic to me that not only was I shut out for speaking out against harm in the form of Russia continuing to push toxic injections on its population, but I was shut out for calling out Russia. So whether that's an algorithmic decision or a human decision, I don't know, but it's quite ironic. And I think it leads us quite nicely into what I want to talk about today. And that is a disturbing development that you and I and others have noticed metastasizing over the past 5+ months since February 24, when Russia entered Ukraine under the auspices of its military, special military operation in inverted commas. And this development has been a certain contingent of people, journalists, analysts, commentators, observers, who've taken it upon themselves to draw a line in the sand, as it were, and say, you cannot be neutral on what's happening in Ukraine. Either you stand with Russia in its supposedly existential fight for humanity against Western Empire, or you are on the side of Western Empire and on the side of the Nazis that are a scourge in Ukraine. And there's no third option. This has become increasingly problematic, and it's at a point now where those who've drawn the line and have taken the side of Russia will not criticize Russia in any way. They will overlook anything that inconveniences their pet narrative with regard to Russia's special military operation and the alleged ascendance of a multipolar New World Order. And in doing so, they're, whether they're aware of it or not, restructuring morality as we know it and making actions by Russia that any right-minded person would call immoral and wrong, making those actions right, justifying them, because Russia's laid out the terms for their conduct, and their conduct is in service of noble ends. And this has become dangerous. This has become lunacy. It's become cultish in a way. The cult of multipolarity is what I like to call it. So I want to dig into this with you because you've noticed it as well. And we've talked about it on this program a bit, as well as off the air. And it's something that very much needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, on the face of it, I mean, one thing that you said there is about possibly about the idea of defining a new morality of sorts. I don't think it is. I think it's the same old kind of protecting the narrative that people have rightly criticized in the past, especially when it's applied to, you know, for example, defending Western imperialism. Then obviously, you know, I think I'm among those people that have been very critical of that. I mean, I obviously there are people who are quote unquote on the ground in the Donbass, for example, reporting from there, and they are, you know, unlike me, who is essentially a document researcher, and my journalism is very much based upon researching, you know, written material and both online and off, and trying to draw conclusions from that and drawing that from the evidence that I'm aware of. And I bring to that my own biases, my own confirmation bias. I mean, you know, I do have, and I am aware of the fact that I have got a And coming it from an anarchist perspective. So to me, I question all government all of the time. And that's a bias. That is a bias. You know, I find it very difficult to accept that a government has done anything valuable. I mean, to be fair as well, when I look at the evidence, I often discover that misgiving isn't misplaced, that more often than not, that is the case.
Right.
But I think if you are in a very different situation, if you're reporting from a war zone and you're subject to the kind of, you know, horrendous sights and sounds that people in war zones witness and experience, of course that will have a massive impact upon, you know, your view of the situation. And I think it's, sure. I think it's absolutely vital. And it's so important, especially in this time when there is a firewall effectively erected between the East and West in terms of information, that those people that are willing to go to these places and to report on the ground and provide on the ground reports are heard and listened to, and that their work is shared as widely as possible. But that doesn't mean that, you know, those people aren't also subject to their own, you know, bias and their own, although they undoubtedly do all that they can to be as objective as possible. It is inevitable that if you are effectively an embedded journalist, which is something that I know people have criticized extensively in the past, that you are yourself are going to be subject to the pressures of, how should we put it, the side that you're embedded with.
Mm-hmm.
Now that doesn't mean that your reporting is unworthy of being heard. And the same should be said for reporting from any other side of the conflict, of any conflict. Then that's the point. I think as people that are trying to establish a clear picture of what is actually happening, we need to hear evidence from every side. We need to gather as much evidence as possible to make up our own minds. After all, right. We are asked to make judgments about it. Our own governments ask us to make judgments about it all the time. So it is really incumbent upon us, it's a duty, to try and figure out what is actually going on. But if in doing so, you simply ask questions about some of the evidence that you're presented with, if that elicits a response which is very defensive or of the position that is that whatever that position might be, then of course that just isn't helpful. It doesn't help. Although it is understandable, because, you know, I'm sure when you're embedded in an environment like that, it's incredibly, you know, what do these things matter in the great scheme of things from your perspective, you know, and I'm speculating here myself, what do these things matter? It's about trying to tell the truth as you see it. But if mm-hmm. you do lose sight of objectivity, which is perfectly understandable, and I'm not saying that is the case, but it is a possibility. If you do lose sight of objectivity, then it is kind of important to be aware, I think, that may affect you. And I've seen, unfortunately, too much death in my own life to know that how it being in an environment like that where extremely distressing things happen has an impact on us. And it, of sure. course it does. But at the same time, as people that are looking at the situation on trying to maintain a sense of objectivity, it is our right to question that information. And it's essential that we do. And if questioning it causes you to be cancelled, then, you know, that just raises a whole set of questions of its own.
Right. I agree with everything you said. And I would add to it that somebody who's reporting on the ground and is witnessing the worst of humanity, that set of circumstances does not give them whatsoever the right to tell other people that they need to take a side, which side they should take, which information they should trust, which information they should discard, and that essentially this is right and that is wrong. Nobody, whether they're a journalist on the ground or a researcher based in a library, has the right to impose that upon anybody. That doesn't make you the arbiter of truth, but a lot of people have taken that position that they are the arbiters of truth, and it spreads to people who are not on the ground who take up that attitude, and it's caused a huge amount of delusion, I would say, in the form of, for example, presenting evidence in Russian media that it is very much, Russia is still very much on board with the COVID delusion and the centralized power that that's enabled, that it's still pushing toxic injections on its population, including children. This is dismissed still as either Russia playing some sort of 5D chess game, or it's ignored outright. It won't be pointed to, it won't be acknowledged, because again, it inconveniences a pet narrative, a fetishized version of events that people have glommed onto. And that's very dangerous. That's a warping of reality, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that we're possibly sort of talking about, you know, slightly two different things, or rather I didn't fully pick up on your point, because I think what you've raised there is a something of a separate issue, because, you know, what we're talking about is an opinion that is subjective, in very much subjective, and it is and you know, most of us that are looking at information about what we might call the difference between the unipolar and the multipolar world order model that we're being encouraged to consider. And I mean, that's another point to consider. I mean, we are ourselves involved in this discussion simply because it's a talking point that's been raised for us. You know, so while we're doing that, you know, what purpose does that serve? But I mean, you could end up going around in a sort of endless set of loops, you know, of you know, self-confirming loops. I mean, the point is that is, I would suggest, everything in terms of whether or not you think that the multipolar world order is some sort of solution to the unipolar world order is absolutely a subjective judgment. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing wrong with expressing a subjective judgment. That's fine. And what we need to be able to do when someone expresses, or when I, for example, express a subjective judgment, is to look at the evidence and you know, try and work out between us and debate, because that is the point of dialectical reasoning, is to debate the evidence and try and come, two heads are better than one, try and come to some sort of meaningful conclusion. That too is fine. But to say that, you know, anything that happens is evidence in support of your argument, and anything that you don't like, you ignore, then again, that brings with it a set of, you know, that raises further issues. You start to suspect a potential agenda, which, mm-hmm. you know, from some observers, you know, that would be very disappointing if that was the case, because, you know, we would hope that there isn't an agenda, because, because perhaps, you know, the tremendous work that they've done in the past to expose problems around the world. And that doesn't mean that of course, that there's that their work suddenly becomes valueless or anything like that. But nonetheless, it does raise concerns. And I, you know, and I hope people would be able to understand that it does raise concerns about potential agendas. And, mm-hmm. you know, personally, as I said right at the beginning of this, you know, I've got a confirmation bias. So I've got my own personal agenda, which I've already explained. But I mean, part of the work that I do, you know, one of the biggest things that I try to do is keep my agenda out of the things I write about. Now I know, of course, that, you know, by the very nature of the subject matter that and the material that I look at that I do write about, it is inevitable that my you know, I'm not perfectly objective, and of course nobody, I don't think, will want to read anything that was perfectly objective. I mean, the idea that journalism is nothing but, you know, that's objectivity is supposed to be science, not journalism. Journalism isn't mm-hmm. about pure objectivity. It's about framing narratives and being able to explain that as best as you can based on the evidence you're aware of. So no one, you know, I certainly don't expect people to be 100% objective. But if you then question what they're writing about or what someone might be saying or what they're broadcasting, and that is met with anger, then of course that suggests an agenda. And I think that is where divisions are created. And I think the biggest problem and the biggest risk with people who are passionate about what they believe in to the extent to which, you know, they cannot brook any criticism or doubt about what they're saying, is that it creates division at a time when we do need to be united if we are going to oppose what is undoubtedly rolling out right now. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, how we perceive that is obviously for a matter of debate, but it doesn't really matter, because whether you value the multipolar world order or you value the oppose the unipolar world order or however you want to frame it, the fact is that this kind of censorship and oppression and the use of potentially dangerous drugs on the population en masse is happening right now everywhere. It's not mm-hmm. everywhere. It's a global phenomena. So in light of that, I think it's important that we all try to do what we can to oppose that, no matter what the source of that oppression is, because it doesn't really matter what it is. The point is that people are at risk from it and they are being harmed by it. And that's what we should be united in defending or standing against, in my view.
Yes. And before we throw it to a quick break, I just want to add to that this push by a certain contingent of journalists, observers, analysts, commentators, that people pick a side and ideally pick the side of Russia means that we have to ignore objective realities, objective harms that are being meted out on the global population that have been for the past 2.5 years, that we have to ignore or suspend disbelief in large part when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China, specifically with regard to the fact that they are pushing the same harmful anti-human agendas that Western Empire is pushing. There is no difference whatsoever. And I want to get into some of that when we come back, because I think whether people are trying to push us away from that or subjectively do not see it as important or relevant anymore. I don't know. I can't speak to people's intentions and I won't try to, but it's dangerous the way that some people have been shepherded away from that to the point where they're daily posting, for example, the Russian MOD's updates without question. But if you question that or point out something that contradicts this fetishization of the multipolar New World Order, it'll be met with either anger or silence. And that's dangerous given what we've lived through for the past 2.5 years, the nightmare that is still very much ongoing. So I want to get into that when we come back. Everybody hang tight and I'll be back with Ian Davis here on TNT Radio after this.
TNT Radio's Christina Borgeson.
So you wrote quite the report. Basically, it's about assessing the WHO's candidacy as an authoritative global public health organization. What I thought was quite brilliant is you started very simply. Here's their constitution. And here's how they say they're going to handle pandemics.
So what I did is I pulled out the evidence from a very long document that the WHO has published in 2019, and in which they say they don't really recommend lockdowns. They actually, the word lockdown didn't exist prior to the pandemic. Lockdowns is a term used in prisons, and it's used to stop riots in prisons. So you don't lock down healthy populations, okay? You quarantine sick people to prevent the spread of a specific disease, but you don't lock down populations. They did not recommend school closures, did not recommend testing and contact tracing for an infectious disease that spreads in the air, because there is no point in that. They did not recommend mask wearing.
Christina Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
My husband, Alex Hussey, was hit by an IED in Afghanistan.
I was point man on foot patrol, and I stopped on the bomb. Lost my legs and left hand in an explosion.
DAV helps veterans of every generation to get the benefits they've earned.
To see Alex learning to snow ski, that's life-changing.
With the right support, more veterans can reach victories great and small.
This has meant so much. Thank you, DAV.
Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zerwell. I am speaking with Ian Davis here on TNT Radio, where, just a quick reminder, we are live 24/7. You can find us on your preferred streaming platform, whether that's Apple, Google Play, Spotify. You can also catch up on back episodes there if you've missed any. And you can find us at our website, tntradio.live. And also, if you're so inclined, download our app from your preferred app store. Ian, there are several things, several developments, more than several, I would say, that we need to question that have been overlooked by a lot of people who were focusing on the COVID delusion and the globalist control that underpinned it for the past 2.5 years. There are several aspects of this, again, more than several aspects, that are being right now carried out by Russia and by China against their populations, and perpetuating this anti-human agenda, whether it's in the form of zero COVID policies and insane lockdowns, or in form of pursuing 2030 agenda goals. Now, I'm looking at a foreign ministry press conference readout given by Wang Wenbin, who is the foreign ministry spokesperson in China. This was on May 17 of this year. And he says in this press conference, the BRICS countries are an important force in addressing climate change and have made BRICS contributions to global cooperation in addressing climate change. At the 75th United Nations General Assembly, President Xi Jinping made a solemn commitment to, quote, strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions by 2030 and strive to achieve carbon neutrality by 2060, unquote. China has built and implemented a carbon peak and carbon neutral 1+N policy system and exceeded its 2020 climate action goals. Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa have also made climate commitments, formulated policies to deal with climate change, and announced corresponding measures. In addition to that, it was reported yesterday by ReclaimTheNet.org that Hong Kong vaccine passport update now connects all checkpoint data to centralized government server. Reuters reported on August 8, more Chinese women delay or give up on having babies after zero COVID ordeal. And it goes on. And as you have pointed out, on February 4, on the sideline of the Winter Olympics in Beijing, Russia and China put forth a document declaring their unlimited friendship, so to speak, and outlining explicitly their commitment to these anti-human climate change policies and commitment to UN Sustainable Development Goals, to Agenda 2030. This is just one example. Another example of something that's being ignored is what just happened in Palestine. We saw 44 Palestinian civilians obliterated in a matter of days, including 15 children, and it was a blip on the radar. Now, I'm not saying it's not important when civilians get shelled in Donbass, but if you watch RT, it's as if it's a thing that comes and goes with Palestine. So all sorts of terrible things that are being done to humanity are being ignored or overlooked or given short shrift. In my opinion, and again, this is in my opinion, in pursuit of placing utmost importance on what Russia is doing in Ukraine to fight Western Empire and help bring forth a multipolar new world order. And in my opinion, again, my opinion, this is very dangerous and is something that needs to be called out and resisted.
Yeah, no, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, if we look at some of the things that China have done, and I think one of the problems we get is that both China and Russia have given this commitment to Agenda 2030 and said they'll pursue it. Now, one of the first things that if you cite that and say, for example, how this debate works, if you cite that and say, well, there we go, they're committed to the same thing, the argument that comes back in your direction is, yeah, but they're not really committed to it. They're building a productive economy. China are building coal-fired power stations as fast as they can, you know, as fast as they can make the bricks. So they're not really committed to it. They're just playing lip service to it. And that, you know, it's all part of this, of their geopolitical strategy to dominate the, you know, or not to dominate, but to fight the unipolar world order and its insane commitment to zero, net zero, and all that kind of thing. Well, but that fundamentally misunderstands what Agenda 2030 is all about. It's not as if it's actually about saving the planet, reducing carbon dioxide, or anything like that. That's not what Agenda 2030 is about. Agenda 2030 is about global control of the population. Mm-hmm. That's its fundamental purpose for existence. And when China are talking about having a zero carbon or net zero carbon account by 2030, presumably China are hoping that most of their rapid development that they're undergoing by that they're undertaking at the moment, and their mass industrialization and hell for leather construction of many coal-fired power stations and other energy producing facilities that are needed to power their massive growth, although obviously that has slowed down recently, but that's a global phenomenon, not just in China, is that, you know, the whole point of Agenda 2030 is that the big producers can then invest and can then mitigate their pollution of the planet with carbon trading and carbon offsetting. That is a big part of what sustainable development is all about. It's not about actually reducing the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere. It's got nothing to do with that. It's about using things like carbon trading. I mean, you know, the envisaged size of the carbon trading market is $120 trillion. Mm-hmm. Of course, every nation on Earth wants a slice of that pie. It's the fundamental basis for a new model of the global economy, one that's not based on oil, but is instead based on carbon offsetting and carbon trading. And it comes with, you know, what I have written about in the past called, you know, something that I would say is the, and something that I know other writers and researchers such as Whitney Webb have written about, which is the financialization of nature. Converting everything that is currently called a global commons, which means forests, mountains, lakes, rivers, trees, the sky, turning those into natural assets, or rather commodities that can be the access to which can be licensed, and then call that the new global economy. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about. That's why every single bank on the planet and every single central bank on the planet, including the Chinese and the Russian central banks, are enthusiastic adopters of Agenda 2030 and sustainable development goals, because it's got nothing to do with saving the planet. It's about enrichment, centralizing as ever. It is about centralizing control and centralizing power. And of course, Russia and China are committed to that. So I don't really see quite, you know, I mean, I think the argument comes from the fact that people fundamentally misunderstand what it's about. I mean, that seems to be where the argument comes, that China are somehow not, or Russia are somehow not working towards this. I mean, we often talk about one of the things that is coming with this new global international monetary and financial system and new global paradigm is, you know, clearly it is going to be based upon the biosecurity state as a kind of management control system for a global technocracy.
Right.
Well, one of the remarkable things, and one of the things that I've been sort of following in China has been the Henan banking crisis, where China did that thing that everybody has been warning about. Everybody that spoke about what was terrible about the rollout of biometric surveillance and the rollout of things like the things that the government in the West are still trying to foist upon their populations, and they're just incrementally bringing. I mean, France recently have just brought in biometric ID for accessing public services. So they're squeezing in this idea that we all need to, you know, give blood samples and basically prove our genetic cells in order to exist, so that they can track and monitor everything we do and restrict access to whatever it is that we need to access in order to, you know, control our behavior. Well, mm-hmm. What people have been warning about in terms of how the unipolar model of this might work is that the that it would soon go beyond just controlling access to, example, health services, and move towards things like banking, and that it would, and that the things like COVID-19 surveillance apps would be effectively misused and used for other purposes. Well, China have already done that. China have already started doing that. The people that were protesting against the Henan banking scandal, where they simply had their bank accounts withheld from them and had no access to money, the bank just decided that, no, you can't have any money. The people that were going to protest that, they were restricted from traveling to those protests because their COVID app was switched to red. So that meant that they couldn't access transport. Now that is the horror of totalitarian control that people have been warning about in terms of the unipolar world order for the last 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And China are one of the first countries, and possibly the first, I haven't checked, but I suspect they're possibly the first country to take that next step. Just as they are miles ahead in running out control systems like central bank digital currency.
Yes.
As are Russia.
Yes.
They are pushing ahead with the very worst aspects of what we might call the new global control system.
Right.
So why on earth anyone would imagine for one minute that the multipolar world order, whatever they want to call it, is somehow going to be better than the WEF-ish version? I've got no idea. It seems to be the WEF-ish version, but slightly in advance. You know, they're ahead of the game at the moment. So
right.
I've got no idea what this notion is, that the multipolar world order is supposed to be somehow better. It just seems ludicrous to me.
Yeah, well, I think I spoke with Fabio Vigi about this yesterday, that on a psychological level, it comes down to a very, very difficult to overcome denial of reality that is surface level, we can perceive it, but nonetheless is still so embedded in our psyches that it's, as I said, almost impossible to overcome. But beyond that, as you pointed out, Russia is very much on board with advancing its CBDC program, its biometric surveillance grid. Our mutual friend and colleague Riley Wagaman has written excellently about this and continues to do so. And it's like he's howling into the wind. Nobody wants to touch this because it goes against, again, this pet narrative that Russia is doing everything right. And if you look at the Bank for International Settlements documents, its reports, it is very excited about the prospects of Russia's digital ruble. Now, I know that Russia is supposedly excommunicated from the BIS, but let's not forget that the BIS has sovereign immunity around the world, and that sovereign immunity extends to its member banks, which includes the Russian Central Bank. And on top of that, because the BIS has sovereign immunity, it can lie about anything it says and not have to be held to account for it. So I don't know, but for all we know, it could be completely lying about Russia's excommunication from the BIS. And the fact that Russia is still able to transact internationally with other central banks leads me to believe that it's settling its transactions with other central banks through the Bank for International Settlements, which exists in part to do that. So there's that. And then we can get into the foreign policy aspect of how China is vehemently aiding and abetting, enthusiastically aiding and abetting the genocidal war on Yemen, selling all types of offensive weaponry to Saudi and the UAE, And in Africa, it is not only importing its own cheap labor, coolie style, and exploiting its workers while not providing jobs for Africans, local Africans. Its infrastructure is very shoddy. It's built hospitals in places and then left them empty because supposedly its remit was only to build the hospital structure and not to provide the equipment for it. It's plundering the natural resources of Africa for rare earth minerals and metals that are needed for all sorts of modern day technologies. And UC Rusal, which is a huge Russian aluminum bauxite company, right now in Jamaica is poisoning rivers there, killing massive amounts of fish. The Jamaicans are all kinds of upset, and rightfully so, about this. But this is written off as part of the multipolar New World Order and economic development. This is not economic development. This is imperialism under the guise of development. And that's a huge, huge anti-human problem that's being missed by this incessant howling that Russia is doing everything right and fighting empire and trying to bring the multipolar New World Order into reality. And it's time we've called this out, because it's a dangerous path we're headed down.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we were looking at in the past was, you know, a form of imperialism based upon military conflict. I mean, beyond, you know, if we're looking at it in terms of it in nation states, you know, not in terms of corporate imperialism, but in terms of nation states, we were looking at control of other and the subjugation of other nation states through military power. We have moved beyond that now. We are now talking about the subjugation of populations through fifth generation warfare or hybrid warfare, whatever you want to call it. It is about the control of information. It is about the access to information. It is about, you know, sowing dissent. I mean, obviously, it's always been about that to a certain extent, but it is more so now about sowing dissent within populations. It is about controlling them within. It is about infiltration. It is about that kind of warfare. Now, I would argue that China and Russia, again, if you look around the world, are ahead on that front. Now, so I suppose the argument would be, well, at least they're not bombing cities. Well, of course, in Russia's case, they are currently. There are all kinds of reasons that we might give and justifications that we might cite for what Russia has been doing in Ukraine. And, you know, they're not, in the great scheme of things, they're arguable points and they're not unreasonable. The circumstances that have led to the conflict are very complex. And I would say that, you know, certainly NATO and the West are just as culpable for that conflict as Russia. But sure. I wouldn't say that Russia is less culpable. You know, the insinuation seems to be that Russia had no choice, that the all it could do was blow people up. That was the only thing, that was the only option it had left, was to shoot people. That's all it could do. I reject that argument utterly. There seems to me that Russia was in a position, certainly with its control of energy for the European Union and for Europe, there were a number of things that Russia could have done economically and industrially and in terms of its relations, its economic relations with Europe in particular, to have resisted what was undoubtedly provocation from the West.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the interesting things about the Minsk Accords and the Minsk Agreements.
I hate to cut in, Ian, because there's so much more we could get into, but we have about 30 seconds left, unfortunately.
Yeah, no worries, mate. No, I was just gonna say, with regards to the Minsk agreements, you know, we could look at them. There is so much more that Russia could have done that it didn't do. And yes, not just, yes. But, you know, it's not just Russia. That's the point. I'm not trying to suggest that Russia are the great evil either.
Right.
They're just
Germany and France shirked their responsibilities there as well. So
absolutely.
And again, when we talk about Russia and China, we're talking about the state apparatuses. We're not talking about the people. So I want to make that point very clear as we sign off here. Ian, thank you very much for joining me and engaging in this conversation. I think it was very important to have, and I appreciate it.
No, well said, mate. No, I agree.